Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Winds of Change here at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM in Victoria. We're heard online at cfuvic.uvic.ca, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us there. And my name is Janine Bancroft. I'm broadcasting from the basement of the Student Union Building at the beautiful University of Victoria campus, which is situated on unceded Coast Salish territories. In the next hour, I'm going to speak in the second half with Jordan Reichert. Jordan is running as a federal candidate with the Animal Alliance Environment Voters Party of Canada. Jordan is an ardent animal rights activist and wants to bring changes to legislation so that animals have some protection, I'm guessing. I don't know. We'll find out in the second half. We'll chat with Jordan. And in the first half, I have Jerry Bill. Jerry's on the line. Jerry is has been on the show several times. I met Jerry during the Cuba caravan many years ago, and he's just returned from Cuba. We'll speak with Jerry shortly. I just want to also let you know at the half, I'll be speaking with Chris Cook with a What in the World update. Chris Cook from Guerrilla Radio, of course. So, Jerry is back from Cuba. Jerry, we are speaking on the very day of Fidel Castro's 89th birthday. How about that?
Well, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? And he's still going strong, in a sense, you know, still making appearances and writing columns and so on. So he's still with us, very much so. And so anyway, thank you for having me on Winds of Change. It's lovely to be speaking with you once again.
Yeah, you too. And, you know, I was at a performance the other night of, it's called Boom, it's at the Belfry. It's a really good program, and it's a one-man show, and he does a history of sort of the world, I guess the Western world, what happened to the U.S. mostly, and Canada's relationship after the Second World War ended with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then all the way up to 1989, and he has images of various historical figures, and he plays different characters, and he plays a clip of Fidel Castro. And Fidel is saying there will be no more dictatorships in Cuba, and someone in the audience laughed as if, oh, haha, what do you mean, you're the big dictator? And I thought, no, you know what, people, why, they think he's a dictator, but I didn't get that impression when I was in Cuba. Do you ever want to say anything about that, Jerry?
Well, yeah, you know, Cuba has a type of democracy that's different than our own, but it's in some ways more democratic than our own. And when you talk to the people, they're very involved in their sort of what we would call local politics. That is, everybody knows personally their representative on the municipal council and so on, because these are small districts and, you know, neighborhood representatives, and anybody can run to be on the council, and that's where it starts. It's sort of grassroots democracy at a very, very low level. And what happens is, at the low level, people talk about things that need to change or things that need to be done, and it works its way up the system until it gets up to the National Assembly. And the people at the municipal council, they elect people to the regional councils, and they elect people to the National Assembly, and so on. So people are very, very connected to their political system, and they do feel like they have a voice in what happens to them, and they exercise that voice. So it's a different sort of system than we have. It's not a two-party system, but it's not exactly a one-party system either. That is, the members of the National Assembly, about a third of them don't belong to any party at all. There's a communist party that you can belong to. That's optional. And then you can just run as an independent, and about a third of the members of the National Assembly are just independents. But there's a feeling, you know, people have the feeling that, you know, what they say makes a difference. And a lot of times in the U.S. anyway, people have the feeling that what they say doesn't make a difference.
Hmm, interesting. And as I recall, everyone who runs at the very local level, like you say, every neighborhood has a candidate, it seems like, they're allocated a certain amount of money, and that's it. And then everybody's equal in that. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's another way in which the system is more democratic than ours, I think. There you have it. And, you know, it was Fidel Castro, now it's Raul Castro, but he gets elected to that position by the National Assembly. And the National Assembly is picked by people who have been picked in the local communities. So that's how it works.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, Jerry, you are a retired college professor, and you've traveled to Cuba many, many times with the Cuba Caravan, the Pastors for Peace Cuba Caravan, that have challenges the embargo. Now, this is the first time that you've traveled to Cuba since the sort of changing relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. In fact, John Kerry's traveling there this week to fly an American flag. Yeah. So, on the ground in Cuba, what kind of things did you notice?
Well, the main things I noticed were at the U.S. border. When we travel to Cuba, we go by way of Mexico, but as we're leaving, the U.S. Exit Customs knows that we're on our way to Cuba and historically have stopped us and searched our stuff, you know, the aid that we're bringing, and usually seized some items. This year they didn't do that. I mean, the last 4 or 5 years, their favorite thing to seize would be some computers. Like, I remember one year we had 130 computers with us, and they seized 6 of them, I think. It's sort of a symbolic thing they had been doing, which they didn't do this year. This year, in preparation on the assumption they were going to seize some computers, we put 5 computers right at the edge of the container. So that they would find those first. And those 5 computers, each one had the name of one of the Cuban 5 on it. And we thought, oh, okay, they're going to seize the Cuban 5, you know. But they didn't even take those. They, you know, they opened up the container and looked at it and looked at everything else and said, you know, closed it up and said, you know, have a good trip. And basically didn't hassle us leaving the U.S. with aid for Cuba, which is a violation of the U.S. embargo to take that stuff to Cuba. Then... coming back, they used to hassle us all the time coming back. You know that. You got hassled yourself. Mm-hmm. And when we, you know, come back into the U.S., passing through Mexico, and we come to the U.S. border, we have to fill out a customs declaration, and then they would take us aside and interview us one at a time and want to know, you know, why we went to Cuba and where we stayed and who we talked to there and not, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we would just refuse to answer. And we had this stock line, you know, you know, on advice of my attorney, I respectfully declined to answer that question. Well, we went through all that training before we came to the border again this time, so everybody knew what to say, but nobody had to say it because as we came, you know, chanting that we've been to Cuba and so on, they just kind of waved us through. They didn't even have us fill out the normal customs forms. So we didn't fill out any customs forms at all saying whether we had any items we're not supposed to bring into the U.S. Of course, we didn't. We're very careful about that with Pastors for Peace. But they just let us go through. So it took us, you know, 5 minutes to get through the border. Usually it took us about 4 hours in the past. So that's where the change has been in the U.S. border crossing thing. The changes in Cuba are not so visible, you know, except that there's what used to be the U.S. interest section is turning into the U.S. embassy. And I don't know if you remember the forest of flags in front of the U.S. interest section that was put there to commemorate all the people who've been killed in acts of terrorism from the anti-Castro Cubans in Miami. Hmm. I think there's it's something like about 150 flags I had there for that number of people that have been killed over the years. They're no longer they were flying those flags partly to block propaganda messages on the side of the U.S. interest section, which was they had a big electronic sign and they'd be putting out anti-Castro propaganda, and the Cubans just put up the forest of flags in front of it. Anyway, the U.S. has stopped doing that, and the forest of flags isn't needed for that purpose anymore, but they still fly flags there on sort of ceremonial occasions. But other than that, I didn't notice a lot of other changes in Cuba related to the more normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Cuba is just perking along like it always does, a strong tourist economy happening and so on. And more and more people, here's something you would have noticed, Janine, more and more people with cell phones, not just cell phones, smartphones, getting access to the internet and so on. And there are certain points in Havana where there's Wi-Fi available.
Wow!
And you see all the young people hanging out there, you know, sitting on the steps or something like that, playing, you know, doing things with their cell phone.
Huh.
So that's, you know, that sort of thing is changing. I think that sort of thing was changing anyway, without regard to this change in relations between the U.S. and Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember that Fidel, as I recall, when I was there, there was talk that, or Raul, I guess, they were negotiating for an underwater cable to bring Wi-Fi, I think it was. So do you think that this, and I know that the introduction of tourism, excuse me, has generated a slightly different socioeconomic relationship among the Cubans.
Yeah.
So with now more cell phones, like, do you think are you noticing that? Or did the Cubans talk at all about, did the guides talk at all about what this change might be or what they're anticipating?
Yeah, they did talk about that. They talked about it quite a bit, of course.
Uh-huh.
They're not anticipating any immediate huge change.
Okay.
Like, the U.S. blockade of Cuba has actually not been lifted. It took an act of Congress to do that. So Obama can't do that. So there isn't going to be a big change in trade anytime soon. Although people would like to see the blockade lifted, they're not expecting it to happen in the next 12 months or so. And then in terms of freedom to travel, here's what Obama has done. He hasn't actually changed the law. He's just made it easier to comply with the law. So that it used to be, to travel to Cuba, you had to fit one of the exceptions in the law, like you were going for educational purposes or you're a journalist or this or that. And there was just a limited number of things you could go to Cuba for. And now U.S. citizens can just make their own travel arrangements and go to Cuba, and nobody asks them. The assumption is that you're going for one of the approved purposes. You're not allowed to go for tourism, but you don't have to tell them you're going for tourism. They just assume that you're going for a legitimate purpose, which is kind of sort of looking the other way, but not having actually changed that law. They're just... in a sense, not enforcing it much. So it's going to be easier for U.S. People to travel to Cuba. There's still no scheduled flights. You have to go on charter flights to get from the U.S. to Cuba,
mm-hmm.
or go through Canada or Mexico. And there you can find scheduled flights, of course. So the Cubans aren't expecting a huge influx right away of U.S. travelers. They expect a gradual increase of that. And that will help their tourist economy, which has become one of the strongest parts of the Cuban economy now.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not worried.
Mm-hmm.
Now people raise the bigger issues, you know, like, well, is this going to mean a McDonald's on every corner,
right.
and so on? Well, the Cubans are smarter than that, and they don't have to allow McDonald's into Cuba. They can decide what companies come into Cuba and under what conditions. And the typical arrangement now is Cuba gets a 60% stake in anything that any company opens in Cuba. So they deal with European companies a lot that put up tourist hotels and restaurants and things like that. And Cuba has a 60% stake and decides what happened, and the employees have to be Cuban and so on. And mainly it's just an investment opportunity for these, you know, Spanish hotel chains and so on to have these hotels going in Cuba. It's going to be the same way with the U.S. If a U.S. hotel chain wants to build a hotel in Cuba, they're going to have to let Cuba control it.
Hmm.
And they can make some money off it, but they have to let Cuba control it. And Cuba doesn't have to let in any hotel chain it doesn't want to. It doesn't have to let in any restaurant chain it doesn't want to. It's up to the Cubans to decide, do we need this? You know, will this be beneficial to Cuban society to have this kind of business in our country? They may decide they don't need fast food. There's a lot of, here's a change you would notice if you went to Cuba now. There's a lot more sort of little local restaurants
mm-hmm.
owned by Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
Not change, you know, just little local things. In sometimes just a converted house. People convert their house into a small restaurant and so on. They have more freedoms to operate small businesses like that. But, of course, the businesses have to be kept small. There's limits on how big they can be. You can't open a little mom-and-pop restaurant on the corner and end up with franchises in every city in Cuba. It doesn't work that way. So Cuba is not going to be taken over by McDonald's or Starbucks or something like that. If those companies come in at all, it'll be under conditions set by the Cubans. And mm-hmm. if the companies don't like those conditions, then they just won't come to Cuba.
Huh, that's so great. Okay. I hadn't ever heard it put that quite that way. And as you say, the Cubans are smart. They're very well educated. And they understand the evils of capitalism. And they've lived this revolution for 50 years through some really hard times. So we have to have faith that they're going to do the right thing. Now, when you mentioned that there's restaurants, Jerry, I know you're vegan. Did you find any better options as far as vegetarian, vegan food availability?
Yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm. And there isn't anything like that I've noticed, like a vegetarian or a vegan restaurant. But mm-hmm. One of the places we went is a cooperative restaurant. Now, that's another thing that's changing. There's more cooperatives being formed, which is sort of a different variation on socialism. And so there's this what they call it, gastronomical workers cooperative or something like that. There's about 60 members of the cooperative, and they run a restaurant and a smaller kind of a grill, you know, a place, but you know, a regular sit down restaurant and then a small place. And they're all members of the co-op. They the co-op makes the money. They pay a certain amount to the government and they keep the rest. They end up with better incomes than if they were just working ordinary jobs, but they're not getting rich either. But they love the work they're doing, and the fact that they are in control. You know, they have an elected board that makes the decisions and so on, and everybody participates in decision making. And so we went to that restaurant, and it's they have a nice selection of stuff, and they did have some vegan and vegetarian things you could eat there, of course.
Awesome.
Although it doesn't specialize in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they're starting to at least understand what that is, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. They have some concept of what that is now.
Okay.
And it's even staying at the churches like we do. The churches are better about that now.
Great.
Because they've gotten used to the idea that they're vegetarians and vegans, and they bring out special dishes for the vegetarians and vegans.
Right.
A little different than what they're serving everybody else at
Jerry's,
church.
Jerry's coming again. We better make some vegan stuff. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got like 5 more minutes. What else did you do in Cuba that particularly sticks in your mind, Jerry?
Well, I went to the graduation of the Latin American School of Medicine, which every year we've been doing that, except it used to be most of the years had been broken into small units. So we'd go to some small venue where we'd see, 200 or 300 people graduating or something like that. This year it was held in the Karl Marx Theater, which is this huge theater that seats over 3,000 people. And all the graduates were there, which was like, I think, over 1,500 graduates. Which, you know, they take half of the theater is taken up just by the graduates and then the rest by their families and guests and so on. Mm. And still there isn't room for everybody that wants to come. But it's really impressive to see 1,500 doctors graduate all at once. This is really the largest medical school in the world. They now have students from 123 countries.
Mm.
When I first started going to Cuba and when the first year I went to the graduation, I think they had students from 29 countries. Well, now it's 123 countries, all being educated for free so that they will go back to their home countries and serve underserved populations in their own countries. This includes the United States, which isn't a poor country particularly, so why do they need to educate doctors for the U.S.? Well, it's because in the U.S., if you go to get a medical education, you probably come out of medical school with a debt of, $200,000 or $300,000 or something like that, and then you have to practice sort of high-priced medicine to make enough money to pay off your big debt. And so this was negotiated actually between Lucius Walker, the founder of Pastors for Peace, and Fidel Castro himself, because they became good friends, and they worked out this deal where 500 slots were allocated for U.S. students at the Latin American School of Medicine. And there are right now, I think, over 100 students from the U.S. there. There were 21 that graduated this year, and we got to meet all of those 21. And there's a very good record for these students graduating from the Latin American School of Medicine. When they come back to the U.S., they get residencies pretty easily, good residencies, and then they, you know, are able to practice medicine the way they want to. These are people going into medicine because they want to help people, not going into medicine because they want to make money. And that's the whole culture of the Latin American School of Medicine. So it was very impressive to, one other time saw this, you know, 1,500 graduates all in one room receiving their medical degrees. But that was something that stood out for me this year.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So are you going to go next year, do you think?
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The plans haven't been made for next year, but I think I'll probably try to go again next year. By then, maybe we'll see more changes coming about because of this change of relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. But again, as I say, that's really going to be kind of a slow process.
Right.
People are delighted symbolically with the fact that there's a new U.S. embassy and a Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C.
Are they? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People are happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't expect their individual lives to change that much until the embargo is lifted, and that hasn't, you know, that isn't really on the horizon yet.
Yeah. Well, now that they're not hassling people at the border, I might even go myself.
That's right.
Really bad experience.
We'd love to have you go again, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so just in the last couple of minutes then, I know you're back in Fresno now, and you're busy helping out at the Dakota Eco Garden. Just want to mention about that.
Oh, yeah, this is a place we have that provides transitional housing for people from the streets, homeless people. And so far, we've had about 30 people come through the Dakota Eco Garden, and many of them have moved on, meaning they've gotten permanent places to live, they've gotten jobs, they've gotten an education, which is why we're there, you see, because once they come to us, they have an address where they can receive mail, they can take a shower every day, they can do their laundry, they can go to school, they can go to work, they can, you know, things they couldn't do very well when they were living on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So it really helps people get on their feet. And the most we've ever had at one time is 13. Right now, I think our count is either 9 or 10 because we just took a new person in yesterday, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really fun project, and it's a nice community there among the people that live there. And they sort of support one another as they move on with their lives. And, you know, of course, some people are dealing with medical issues or mental health issues. And, of course, we have people in recovery from drug addiction and all those kinds of things. And it's a supportive community to help people get through that phase in their life.
So great. All right, Jerry, I wish we had more time, but that's wonderful. We're going to chat again soon, I hope.
Okay.
And thank you so much for all that you're doing for our world.
And thank you for Winds of Change and reporting on this stuff.
Thank you. And everybody who supports this station and this program. That's wonderful.
Okay.
Take care, Jerry.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
That's Jerry Bill. He lives in Fresno, California. And now you are listening to the Winds of Change at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. I'm going to go get a hold of Chris Cook for a What in the World update. And I'll leave you with a song from Maccabee. This is called System No Nice.
You know I said the system's not nice. Babylon system's not right. Me say the people must unite. Them better stand up and fight for them right. Me say the system's not nice. Babylon system's not right. Me say the people must unite. Them better stand up and fight for them right. How when me said, yo. We bring a brighter day. Me say the Babylon system a fi fade away. I say can't take the people them fi fool, 'cause them tired of a living under them kind of rule. And the same thing every day. Me say the poor man a pressure in a every way. It's like a little game them play. Them better listen what the people them say. The system not nice. Babylon system's
not right, right. Me say the people must unite. Them better stand up and fight for them right, right. Me say the system's not nice, nice. Babylon system's not right, right. Me say the people must unite. Them better stand up and fight for them right, right. How come the system so wicked and so evil? How come the system's oppressing the people? How come the system is taking so much life? The system could have never survived. People have to organize, centralize. People have to get wise. Them respect and them dignity, them must exercise. In yourself, have the confidence and answer the pride. And let the most high Rastafari your guide. Politicians have lied, took the people for your ride. Because of this your system, many people have died, many mothers have cried, some commit suicide, couldn't live a good life no matter how much they tried. The only way to make things better is the people have to unite and all come together. Instead of this a selfish life, them have to all try to help one another. The system no nice, nice. Babylon system's not right, right. Me say the people must unite. Them better stand up and fight for them right, right. Me say the system's not nice, nice. Babylon system's not right, right. Me say the people must unite. Them better stand up and fight for them right, right. Me say the system's not nice, nice. Babylon system's not right, right. Me say the people must unite. Them better stand up and fight for them right, right.
Are you a young Aboriginal entrepreneur between the ages of 19 and 35? Want to win $10,000? The Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business is calling for self-nominations for the National Youth Aboriginal Entrepreneur Award. Submit a 30 to 60 second video about you and your business. The deadline to apply is August 24th, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more information, go to ccab.com.
In the world.
And now the What in the World segment with Chris Cook, whose phone line is no longer off the hook. Hi, Chris. How's it going?
Hola, hola, Janine, and feliz cumpleaños, Fidel Castro.
Si. What's going on in the world, man?
Well, Janine, I thought I would try to theme it today. You know, it's something I haven't done in the past. But before I get to the big theme, I've got to just talk about my breaking news scoop. You know, yesterday on my program, Guerrilla Radio, that airs on CFUV Wednesdays at 1 p.m., I spoke with a longtime environmental activist extraordinaire, Igmar Lee, and he announced on my show, that's Guerrilla Radio, airing Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on CFUV, that he is seeking the Green Party nomination for his riding on the Central Coast for the next federal election. Can you believe it?
Is he really going to do it?
Well, he says he's already approached the Green Party. Now he's waiting to hear. If he's accepted, because he said, well, he might be a little bit, he's hoping that he's not too extreme for the Green Party, definitely for the NDP. And he'll be running against NDP heavyweight and the former leadership candidate, Nathan Cullen. And Igmar was hilarious in talking about Nathan and his attempts to get to pin him down on the NDP and his personal position on Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain pipeline. And he said after talking to the guy for 2 hours, he couldn't get, after begging the guy, come on, just give me a bone here, the guy wouldn't be budged. And so Igmar says that he's disgusted by the NDP, that's a quote, and their failure to oppose Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain. And he adds that, quote, a vote for Mulcair is a vote for Kinder Morgan. So, there's a good friend, Igmar. We're going to follow that up with more information as it unfolds, and hopefully he will be accepted by the Green Party, because nobody's got greener credentials than that guy. And Also, you know, I recently had a personal near encounter with the Green Party leader, as it happens, mm-hmm. Elizabeth May. This was just a couple days before the big McLean's Magazine-sponsored federal leaders debate that was televised and webcast last week, or a week and some, I think, by now. But, yeah, we shared a ferry ride from the Sunshine Coast, and this is where I'm getting into the theme thing here, Janine.
Mm-hmm.
But we just come back from Gibson's, where now they were just talking about putting in a stage 4 water restriction. There is no stage 5, by the way. So, you know, it's a pretty serious thing, and everybody was talking about water. That hadn't happened when we were there, but now it has happened. And what that means is that people can't water outdoors at all. I mean, you can't even take a hand water or bucket water your plants unless you're using gray water, you know, like your dish or bath water or whatever like that. So, I mean, this is how serious it is. I mean, this is even for your vegetable gardens and everything. Now, farmers have an exemption for that. Food farmers do. I don't know about tree farms, if they have any up there. But while we were visiting Gibson's now, this is the reality part, that the locals there were telling us about these two controversial condo developments that were going to go in right along the town's harborfront there. And you might remember, Janine, that Gibson's is where they shot the iconic CBC TV show back in, I guess it was the 80s, The Beachcombers, and that was Gibson's. And so they still get loads of tourists that come down there, want to go in to Molly's Reach restaurant, and there's even a replica or maybe the original of Bruno Gerussi boat there up on the right up at the harbor front there. You know, it's a lovely little place. But the funny thing is that not one person, either pro or con, whether or not these condo developments, and they're going to be big ones too, right in on the harbor, not one of the persons that I talked to, at least, mentioned water as being a limitation or a factor even in the decision on whether to, you know, bring these big developments with all the, you know, people and everything else that it entails into the community. And now, I mean, they can't even water their roses, I mean, let alone, you know, bring in hundreds and hundreds of retirees. And what this made me think is that, or at least what it proves to me, is that this relentless development mentality exists, here it comes, outside of reality. I mean, if not one of these people could even see it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And the water supply was something that everybody was talking about, you know what I mean, because they knew that the level 4 restrictions were coming. So, well, what this made me relate to as well, Janine, was that this idea of endless expansion, this mindset that runs throughout Western capitalist philosophy, like endless growth requiring endless supplies of the Earth's resource and endless wars to secure those resources from your market competitors and that. Well, how do we respond to this in the real world, in what we call the real world? Well, we do this by taking our children down to the waterfront to watch warplanes painted in pretty colors do ballets while fireworks and stuff go off at the same time. And this is how this is the reality space that capitalism has forced upon us.
Oh, my God. I don't even know what to say to that. Yeah, no. Well, and the amount of money.
Did you see the air show yesterday?
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
It's so, how much does that cost, and the greenhouse gases and all the rest of it? Yeah. You know, I'm currently up in Mill Bay, and I'm walking these doggies, and we go to a suburb where they have level 3 water restrictions right now.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about this suburb is it's fairly new suburb, and their houses are quite massive. They're very attractive looking houses, and some very large lots, and some people are actually growing gardens in their lots. But they've left the ravine right through the middle, so you can pretty much drive down any street and enter onto this path that goes through, you know, the old rainforest there and alongside the ravine. And I just thought, you know, what if this whole continent could have been built like that, right? It didn't have to all get paved over and, like you say, you know, building right up to the waterfront and, yeah. Well, but I guess people keep having kids, and kids got to live somewhere, Chris.
Well, the population has grown a lot out here, and this is what I'm thinking about, is that, you know, nobody's talking, I mean, in Victoria or in Gibson's or anywhere else, nobody's talking about limiting this or saying, well, okay, sorry, everybody, but the city's full now, and nobody new can move in. I mean, you're never going to hear that from any politician of any stripe, even our good friend here, Lisa Helps, the mayor of Victoria. They're putting in high-rises.
Mm-hmm.
downtown, they want more and more people to get a bigger and bigger tax base. That's great, but those people require water, they require electricity, they require space for their automobiles and everything else. You know, I mean, even as the jets were flying overhead, there's cougar sightings down in Victoria. I mean, the wildlife is so parched that they're getting, drawn to the water, where the water seems to be flowing like wine. Like, I'm surprised they're not down on the Harris Green. I go by there every morning, and the sprinklers are going full speed so that the homeless people, the people left behind by this stupid economy, can't sleep anywhere, you know. So, I mean, the rest of us can be a desert, but the Harris Green will be a lush savanna.
Yeah, I noticed Camosun, Uvic look pretty green, too. Yeah, we got to really get a grip on this. I guess we just take water for granted because it has tended to rain in the winter, but who knows when that will change.
Well, this reality, it's a real reality gap here, the idea that water just doesn't come out of the wall whenever you want it, and cheaply as well. I mean, people really have to sort of start looking around and looking at the sky and seeing behind the chemtrails and seeing that, hey, we haven't had rain in months, and we had a dry winter and a dry winter before that, and we were looking at a dry fall to come, Now, what does this mean, and is anybody taking this seriously?
Well, we're taking it seriously, and my next guest is running with the Animal Alliance Environment Voters Party of Canada, Chris, so I'm going to go get a hold of him now, and then we can ponder all of this wisdom that you've bestowed upon us and that you bring to the airwaves every Wednesday 1 till 2 p.m. at Guerrilla Radio. People can go to your website at pacificfreepress.com.
Well, thank you, Janine, and I'll echo Jerry's sentiments. We're all very appreciative of all the hard work that you put in and have put in these many long years on your program,
well,
The Winds of Change.
Yeah, thank you. Back at you, Chris. All right, take care.
All right.
Bye. Chris Cook. And I'm going to play a little bit from Mumia Abu-Jamal, who suffered some health diabetes, apparently. He's in prison, and I don't know if people know the story. I'll have to go online because I'm running out of time. I'm going to just play this and go get a hold of Jordan. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal from behind prison walls.
Trump and the politics of resentment. When New York billionaire and GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump launched into his anti-immigrant tirade against Mexicans crossing the border, he was using a long-term political technique of plugging into the live wire of American resentment of the other. Today, it's Latinos, of course, more precisely, those from the southern borders, Mexicans, Salvadorans, Guatemalans, Hondurans, and the like. But since the 19th century, politicians have used these currents of fear to fuel movements against those who came from abroad. In those days, though, the targets of nativist ire were those from Ireland, Jews from Russia, people from Italy, and other European sites. These forces gave birth to the American Party, a fierce anti-immigrant group that became known popularly as the Know-Nothings. They formed a third party during the 1850s and ran former U.S. President Millard Fillmore as their unsuccessful candidate. U.S. historian Richard Hofstadter, in his classic work, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, argued that much of the energy of the anti-immigrant forces stemmed from what might be called status anxiety, or the intense insecurities of people unsure of their place in U.S. society, but who could point to others, immigrants, who held weaker positions in society. Furthermore, these same anxiety-ridden groups often have mixed feelings of fear and admiration of social elites. And who is more elite in America than the super rich? Witness the spectacle of Donald Trump, who, without question, is perhaps the richest man ever to run for president, and as a billionaire populist, no less. I wouldn't get too excited about his place in the polls right now. In 2012, the toast of both press and polls was a pizza exec named Herman Cain. We know how that worked out. But most candidates, especially of the GOP, worship at the throne of the wealthy, for they are the ones they serve. The thousands and perhaps millions who rage at Latino immigrants also worship the rich. In Donald Trump, they have found their voice, and he has found the energies of resentment, undeniable fuel for failure. from Imprisoned Nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mumia. All right. Jordan Reichert is running in the federal election with the Animal Alliance Environment Voters Party of Canada. Jordan, thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Janine. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So who is this Animal Alliance Environment Voters Party of Canada? Is this a new party?
Well, it's not a new party, actually, and that's a question I've been getting a lot as I've been talking to people in the community and out collecting signatures, which I'm happy to say I just collected my 100th signature for my nomination papers.
Yay, and happy birthday to you, by the way.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been a great day so far,
good.
And really glad I could be on the show today, too. The party was started in 2006 by party leader Liz White. And so far, generally, its base has been in Ontario. There's been in 2011, they did run 7 candidates and received over 1,400 votes. So, you know, it's a growing party over the last several years. And, it's going to just keep growing as people become aware of it. And that's an important thing or aspect of what we're doing right now is raising awareness that there is an alternative party. There is a party that that really cares about the way society treats animals and the way the laws protect them. And there is an option on voting day to go out and make that count, not just for all the people, human animals out there, but also all animals everywhere.
Well, so that's kind of the main focus then. So it's Animal Alliance Environment Voters. I guess Liz is encouraging the connection between animal agriculture and environment?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, certainly it's what catches people's attention when they first see the party name, of course, is Animal Alliance Environmental Voters. But, you know, the animals are not the only part of our platform. We do have a full platform with aspects of democratic reform, health care. We have issues we want to deal with in the economy, social welfare, education. I mean, these are all important things, and because they're all integrated into a healthy society and a society with a comprehensive plan for moving forward together. But the animal aspect is something that's been generally left out by all the major parties. When we look at their platforms, they do some of the parties do have some animal welfare aspects in their platforms, but we don't feel that they go far enough, and we don't feel that they're necessarily committed to making those election issues. And these are election issues to, we believe, you know, hundreds of thousands of people across Canada who, you know, care for animals themselves or are, you know, or care about the animals that are used in various industries in our society and often treated cruelly or inhumanely and want to see that changed.
Okay, and so is the platform available somewhere online?
Yeah, if people go to environmentalvoters.org, they can check out what the platform is, what we're doing, the candidates, and all the work, and find out a little bit more about who the party is. And been giving a lot of information out to people recently about to go check out the website. And I'm not up there on the website yet, but I will be once all the paperwork's done and such.
So how many candidates are they running this time around?
Well, the official number hasn't been settled yet, but like I said, around 7 candidates in the last election, and so I hope that number is going to be increasing this year.
That's so great. Okay, I'm interested to know about other similar parties around the world. I spoke with a fellow from Australia not too long ago and was kind of surprised to hear that they've actually elected people from an animal advocacy party. I forget the exact name of it. So are we kind of behind the times in Canada in terms of this idea of electing people on a platform of concern for all animals?
Yeah, I really think we are. I mean, you look at Europe especially, In Germany, for example, in the 2014 European parliamentary elections, over 366,000 votes were people voted for the Human Environment Animal Protection Party, which you know is a huge percentage. You've got the Party for Animals in the Netherlands, which actually holds two seats in the European Parliament. And you've also got, and received over 200,000 votes. You've got the Animal Welfare Party in the UK. They also received over 21,000 votes. So, you know, in Europe especially, you know, we see much more progressive policies on social issues and animal justice issues, animal rights issues. And they really take it seriously there. And there's actually a group, they're called the Euro Animal 7, and it's made up of a collective of various parties, including the ones from Germany, Netherlands, the UK, Spain, Cyprus, and other places that, you know, work together kind of as a whole to, you know, promote the parties and to do what they can to increase protections for animals.
And have they had any success with introducing legislation to protect animals?
Well, you know, it's because they have a minority of seats, they only have a couple of seats, their successes have been limited. But, of course, they have a strong potential to campaign. So one of the things in the UK is like campaigning to redirect subsidies away from livestock and fisheries into plant-based agriculture, which is something, of course, dairy meat industries and such are, a lot of these are heavily subsidized here in Canada, while, you know, people are paying exorbitant amounts for just organic produce, right, or just produce in general. And, you know, shifting away from that, supporting local produce, farming and such across Canada.
Are you still there? Oh, crap. Really?
They actually... Oh, pardon me?
Oh, we lost you for a minute there. So you were saying about the subsidies that we're paying, that we could be paying to organic farmers instead. Jordan, can you hear me? Can you move around?
So can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. Okay. I can hear... Say...
Am I back?
You're back. Okay. Oh, you're gone again. Jordan, I'm going to put some music on, and I'm going to call you back. So if you just hang by your phone, and everybody stay tuned, and I'll see if we can get Jordan with a better connection. All right, we'll be right back. You can listen to some, how about Bruce Coburn? Here we go.
Sunset is an angel weeping, holding out a bloody sword. No matter how I squint, I cannot make out what it's pointing toward.
Okay, we've got Jordan back. All right, so let's carry on with this conversation. Kind of forgot where we were now.
So, I mean, not just organic farming, but just plant-based farming, of course, which has, you know, such an incredibly less profound impact on the environment, which is something that, I mean, you have, Chris, who was just on, was talking about water shortages here. You've got water shortages in the U.S., you know, all across North America and the world, there's water shortages going on, right? And so, of course, we know now that that livestock, animal agriculture production is probably the leading contributor to that in the world, and yet This is not something that is being addressed by any of the major parties right now. They want to talk about pipelines, which, of course, are very important, and we want to talk about pipelines too. But we also need to include the fact that, you know, the effect that it's going to have not just on the sovereignty of First Nations, but also on the effect on animal caribou herds that might go through those places, the effect of tankers and oil spills on whales and on fish and organic life living in the ocean. And so, you know, we need to see this in a more holistic way rather than just focusing on the economy purely and this infinite growth program that the current government has going.
Well, the current economy, really, it's capitalism that demands this perpetual growth cycle, I think, as well. A lot of smaller parties talk about electoral reform, and I think that a lot of the, you know, that's how the Green Party got in Europe and other places, and that's how probably these animal advocate party members got in various places, is when you have proportional representation and where our vote actually counts, and it's not just distributed among the various candidates. And then, you know, is that something that you guys are talking about as well?
Absolutely, yeah. It's part of our platform that we'd like to see the first-past-the-post system that's currently in place gone and be replaced with a mixed-member proportional representation system. This is, of course, allows for electoral diversity, and it is in the Netherlands, where the Party for the Animals has elected their members. This is the type of system that enabled that.
Right, right. And, you know, I like this holistic view that you talk about, because when, you know, when we're talking about pipelines, you're right, we're talking about Indigenous sovereignty and environment, but all the animals, and not just the big animals that we think of, but all the little animals and the mushrooms and the microbes and the all the little creatures that decompose stuff in our earth. I mean, it's so amazingly interconnected. And if we look at it, that, you know, harm none, absolutely none, then I think that is a really great place to go. And especially also, you know, we know that our health is impacted when we consume animal products. So I wonder about the costs to healthcare. Are there any studies, I wonder, Jordan, connecting, you know, like there is now with the connection between cancer and cigarettes, we just know that impacts our healthcare system overall. Do we have any idea about animal consumption related illness and the impacts on the health system?
Yeah, well, we know that. I mean, it has a tremendous impact, and of course, it's one of the leading causes of health disease, heart disease, cancer, other things in the world today. Of course, many of the animals used in intensive factory farming, which many people eat, are pumped full of antibiotics and other harmful chemicals. Of course, by the time they're processed and delivered to the supermarket or wherever people buy them, they're treated so many times that they're basically toxic to the body. So, you know, part of what we propose is the consumption of a whole food, plant-based diet. So, you know, promoting policies. Right now, the Canada Food Guide, as it stands, doesn't really support that in a holistic way. It kind of just says, you know, just recently or fairly recently added, you know, meat and dairy alternatives to the list. But it's still, of course, what they're promoting, because there's lobby groups from the meat, dairy, egg industries that really want to make sure that people keep eating meat, eggs, and dairy first. But, of course, people are really scared of, you know, stop to not drink their milk because they think their bones are going to become brittle and fall, and they're going to be weak at an older age, or they're not going to grow up healthy and strong. And this is just propaganda put forward by the dairy industry in many cases. So, I mean, there is information out there as well. The Dietitians of Canada, Panacea for Modern Lifestyle Change, the NCBI, and there's also some other research that shows that basically, you know, currently what we're doing is we're taking abused, sick, and mistreated animals, and we're ingesting that into our body in a way that is making us sick again, and it only makes sense. And of course, we have to be careful, of course, when we think about a plant-based diet as well, because we have to be aware of how to do that properly. And of course, you meet people who try a plant-based diet and it doesn't quite work for them, but that's something that we want to educate people about, is how to live on a plant-based diet in a healthy way that's holistic, takes care of all their needs, and improves their health. And of course, this attaches to healthcare, and that we need a preventative healthcare model, not a reactionary one, not a disease treatment system. We need something that, you know, promotes health to people before they get sick, and stop just trying to give them a pill after the case to fully solution or solve these problems.
So, okay, so we've got like 2 minutes left. So you're not going to force everybody to become vegan, but you're going to help them learn about the options. And you're doing that already, Jordan, through Viva. Do you want to talk for a couple of minutes about what Viva is?
Yeah, and I think it's really important for people to recognize that, you know, it's an opportunity for people, right? If they care about the environment, if they care about their own health, if they care about the health of society. I mean, veganism is an opportunity for people to make a positive change. However, of course, there's organizations such as the Vancouver Island Vegan Association, and we're trying to welcome people to a plant-based diet in a way that is palatable for them. We want to show people that vegans are strong, healthy people, participating in society from all walks of life, and doing a lot to, you know, change the world today, not just for animals, but for human animals as well. And, you know, of course, we have athletic clubs, we have vegan night outs, we have support groups. We have all sorts of things going on that we welcome people to, vegan or not, to get involved in and find out more. We have a vegan mentor program as well for people who are curious. And they can find out all about that at VancouverIslandVegan.com. And definitely encourage people to take advantage of that.
All right, Jordan, we're out of time, but happy birthday and good luck. And thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Okay, take care. Jordan Reichert is running with the Animal Alliance Environment Voters Party of Canada. You've been listening to The Winds of Change at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! I'll leave you with Bruce Coburn, Pacing the Cage. Thanks for listening.
Sunset is an angel weeping, holding out a bloody sword. No matter how I squint, I cannot make out what it's pointing toward. Sometimes you feel like you've lived too long. Days drip slowly on the page. You catch yourself pacing the cage. I've proven who I am so many times. The magnetic strip's worn thin. And each time I was someone else, and everyone was taken in. Powers chatter in high places, stir up eddies in the dust of rage. Set me to pacing the cage.
I never knew what you all wanted, so I gave you everything. All that I could pillage, all the spells that I could sing. It's as if the thing were written in the constitution of the age. Sooner or later, you'll wind up facing the cage. Sometimes the best map will not guide you. You can't see what's round the bend. Sometimes the road leads through dark places. Sometimes the darkness is your friend. Today these eyes scan bleached out land for the coming of the outbound stage. Facing the cage. Facing the cage.